Are you listening? Damn.
And welcome back once again to the Endurance Hour podcast alongside Wendy Mader. I'm Dave Erickson. Our first question of the podcast today is from David, who asks, doing my first 70.3 in November, I have done shorter triathlons before and have good base fitness for running and cycling. Would you suggest a coach for preparation, or is it doable to just follow a workout plan? Wendy?
Hey, David. Congratulations on getting into the sport of triathlon, and that's a really good question. I believe it was two or three episodes ago on the podcast, Dave and I actually talked about the benefits of getting a coach versus just following a training plan. And I want to stress that coaching is all about accountability and education, and that's something that you can't necessarily always get if you do follow a training plan, except in actually the training plans that Dave and I have created on Training Peaks. We provide a lot of educational content within the plan, and we do weekly videos, or sometimes it's every 4 weeks. You see Dave and I talking about an explanation of the next week or the next phase of training. So we do like to provide a lot of education within the training plan. When it comes to jumping up a distance, like going from a sprint and Olympic to a half, that's a pretty big jump. And I think everyone will benefit from coaching, again, from that accountability and education component. And just to, you know, you don't have to sort through the unlimited information that you find online and that you find on social media. If you're part of a social media group, like a Facebook group, you're going to get, you know, ask a question, you're going to get 1,000 different answers if there's 1,000 people in the group. So sometimes it just makes it really easy for you to get some coaching. And if you, you know, interview the coach and you trust the coach and you're into their philosophy and all that, you guys are a good match. It just makes training so simple for you as the athlete, as you're venturing into this new distance.
Yeah, that's a big jump. Let's say you could do an Olympic in 3 hours, just kind of round out number. You can double that in a half Ironman distance, and nutrition is different. You could undertrain or overtrain if you're doing it on your own and going on feel, just following some workout plan you saw online. I think the coaching at that distance is probably more important, is more important than Olympic for sure. So someone can see you, and it really is personalized. It's everyone's on a different journey, and your body reacts differently. And for someone to watch you and see your results or your data from an outside perspective can help you see things that you don't see, especially with their experience from doing it themselves and working with other athletes, thinking, okay, well, this is how this person reacts. Here's how you react. Okay, you can't just do the same plan. And that's where I think that coach comes into play, especially when you make that jump from the Olympic to the half.
Yeah, and you know, sure, you can do it on your own. I mean, some of the plans that Dave and I created, the couch to Olympic, couch to sprint, couch to 70.3 and couch to Ironman, we created those based on an interview I had an athlete who did an Ironman as his very first triathlon on his own. So he didn't even follow a plan. He just did his own thing, completed an Ironman, was so excited about his experience, he wanted to talk to a coach, and that's how he found me. And we have an interview podcast with him. And so, you know, you can do it on your own, but I think it'll be a lot more simplified if you hire a coach and you form that relationship and you have someone who gets it and is there on your journey with you, rather than trying to do it alone and kind of being, I think people get bogged down with so much information, it could be really overwhelming. And if you find a coach is specifically creating the plan tailored towards your experience, your goals, and your time available to train, it just takes the guesswork out of it.
Mm-hmm. Next up, and this is kind of related to what's happening this coming weekend, Tom writes, I'm headed to Kona. He got his own legacy slot a few years back and finally heading to Kona this year, which is returning to the Big Island at the end of the year. Now that I'm riding more outdoors, please share any suggestions for riding with strong head and crosswinds. I bring this up because they're having the Ironman World Championship in St. George this year, which is happening this weekend, as opposed to on the Big Island. So you've been to Kona a number of times. Can you do anything that simulates, or how do you adapt to the headwinds and crosswinds of the Big Island?
Yeah, you know, that's I think the biggest battle, at least I face as an athlete. My biggest struggle is those headwinds, more importantly, the crosswinds, especially on the Javi section. You know, you start your climb to Javi, it's the only real climb in the course. It's on the, I believe it's the southernmost part of Kona, and it could just be a dead on headwind during the climb. It could be a headwind on the descent, but you will experience crosswinds, and trying to stay on the bike in a crosswind, especially if you're a smaller athlete, is a little bit more difficult. And there are some things you can do to prepare. Number one, you know, within your training, if it's a safe wind to train in, don't be shy and try and train indoors if it's a windy day. I mean, we're talking winds, you know, less than 30 miles an hour. You don't want to go out when it's 50, 60, 70 miles an hour, like I hear it is sometimes in Colorado. But make sure you know what a crosswind feels like and a headwind and a tailwind feels like, because as you get more accustomed to riding in different wind conditions, then you know what kind of gear you want to be in. You know how, if you're training with a power meter or heart rate monitor, or just on a rate of perceived level of effort, you kind of understand what's going on with those metrics as you're pushing into the headwind, as well as you know, you're pushing into a tailwind. You don't want to be on a course and be like, oh, I'm flying, I'm going 25 miles an hour. If you are going 25 miles an hour, chances are high when you turn around, you could be going 10 miles an hour. So just understanding, you know, what wind can do for your speed, especially as a beginner. Also, you want to be, you know, kind of a small, compact, as best you can into a wind. You don't want to be like this big person sitting up on your bike, creating a lot of drag, because then there's more chances for you to kind of get hit or knocked over with a crosswind. You want to know what you need to do to maintain a level of bike handling and being comfortable, and where to position your hands on your aero bars or the regular handlebars of your bike. Something that I learned is when I'm descending Javi with crosswinds, I usually have one arm like in the aero position and then the other arm on my brake. So for me, it gives me a little bit more control if a gust is going to happen to me. And I think the best tip that I received that was very useful for me is looking ahead at other athletes in front of me and looking to see if they're making any movement side to side. Because if I see an athlete in front of me who's, you know, trying to handle their bike, or who may get a little pushed into the road or may get a little pushed to the side of the road, I know the crosswind's coming up. And so I kind of get myself a little bit more braced on my bike so I don't fall over.
I had a couple of points. One was going to be that one. Second is that in Hawaii, there are these cutouts in the lava fields where it looks like a small ridge that the road's been cut out so you can go through that area. On that back end of that, you'll have a wind that surprises you. So that's something to prepare for when you go to the Big Island, that you come into these little, it's almost like a tunnel, but it's not a tunnel, but you have these little side hills on you, which is going to cut all the wind away, so you feel like, oh, it's cool. And then you exit that little section, and boom, you can get hit off the side. I've done the 70.3 Hawaii, so I'm a little familiar with that part of the course, riding it in person, so I know that. Next, if you are
I
riding
mean,
out,
when let me just point, you know, just make sure you need to be prepared for the wind. So, I
yeah.
mean, if just knowing that you need to prepare yourself for the wind is going to be a step ahead of not knowing.
Yeah.
Knowing that it's probably going to be on that heavy section that's going to give you the most problems. And if you can get to the race ahead of time and you have a chance to ride up and down that heavy hill, that'll give you more experience knowing what you may face on race day.
My next one was thinking, because I was doing this yesterday. You know, I was riding on a kind of a highway, but you know, big shoulder there. That when the semis go by you, that's an experience. That's when there's a push, and you can feel that. And that's when you get in, you know, hang on to the handlebars a little tighter. You slow up a little bit, sit up a little higher for those crosswinds. Similar to a crosswind is when a semi goes by and you can hear them coming. It's like, okay, I need to hang on to this one. That was another one. My last one is. His question is, please share any suggestions for riding with strong headwinds and crosswinds. Watch your power. Don't fight against the winds. Just focus. One of the things I'd say is focus on your power. Try to stay consistent with that, because even if you go with the wind, hey, you're going faster, but how's your power? Are you pushing too many watts going faster? And then if you're going against the wind, are you pushing too many watts trying to maintain a certain speed? Trying to let the weather dictate your effort if you can.
Yeah, and I mentioned, you know, proper gearing. I like to push a little bit bigger gear than I normally would into the wind. And usually that actually lowers my power a little bit if I'm pushing a bigger gear, but I just feel more in control of the bike if I'm going in a direct headwind. And again, it's mainly those crosswinds. I don't know if you can ever really fully prepare for the crosswinds other than knowing that it could come, and you just got to kind of brace yourself. And the goal is to not get blown over. It does happen. I've seen athletes on the road in Kona who have gotten blown over on their bike. I've heard stories. And, I play it safe. You know, the Kona bike course is not my strength because I play it a little bit safe on that descent more than my competitors do. But for me, ultimately, that is just better for me in my mind, is to just go a little bit slower and play it safe.
Got a three-part or trifecta of swim questions. They're all short ones. First part of it is Pat asking, my arms get tired very fast when swimming. What's the exercise I can do to help with this?
Hey, Patrick. The first thing I would say is send me a swim video for analysis so I can, you know, look at your swim technique, maybe offer some tips based on maybe you have a limiter, so a swim technique limiter that you need to work on. So a lot of it could be technique based. Also, maybe you're just not swimming enough. The frequency of your swimming needs to increase so you can get your muscles used to swimming. Number three, I should have mentioned this first, is are your arms getting tired? Arms meaning kind of the forearm or your biceps getting tired, your triceps or your shoulders, or are your lats getting tired, your back? Because when a swimmer asks me about tell me that their arms are getting tired, I definitely think it's a technique thing, because you want your lats to get tired, your rear deltoids, the backs of your shoulders, and your triceps. So understanding the right phrase of what actually is getting tired. And then something that could also help is doing some strength exercises in the weight room with bands, dumbbells, free weights, barbells, whatever you have access to, even body weight exercises, where you're targeting mostly the swimming specific muscles that I already mentioned, your lats, your back, your rear deltoids, the backs of your shoulders, and your triceps. That can help you build some strength and some resistance to fatigue.
Danielle asks, any suggestions for goggles that don't fog? Apparently she's having fogging issues in her goggles.
We've actually talked about this way back at another podcast. So since I've been using Blue 70 goggles, chances of my goggles fogging have been way less. I've done some of my epic New Year's Eve and Christmas Eve swims where I'm swimming for multiple hours at a time, and I've never had fogging issues. Also, I've noticed when it comes to open water swimming, when I put my goggles on at first and I don't, you know, do this with them, I don't put them on my head and put them back on, once they're on and sealed and I start the race, they don't fog.
Me too.
I find that when I've been waiting in line and messing with my goggles and putting them underwater and just kind of messing with them, chances are higher that they're going to fog. Another trick that you can do if they do fog is to spit in them and then slosh your spit around in the goggle to cover it with your spit. That's a way to, you know, create an anti-fog repellent in your goggles. Mm-hmm. And then they also have anti-fog stuff that you can use. I've never used it, so I'm not sure how effective it is. But definitely getting goggles, it's definitely a preference thing, you know, how well they fit. You might also want to try Aquasphere, is another brand that I've had success with, where I get the kind of the bigger goggle. It's almost like a scuba diving type of goggle. I don't know what they're called, but they're bigger and they just fit around your eyes and your forehead and cheeks a little bit different than your typical goggle. That might help. What do you think?
Agreed. I think the first thing that you said, and I do this too, and I've noticed the difference, If I just put them on and start swimming, it stays clear longer. But the moment I take a break or I'm in between sets and take them off or splash them, then they have more residue in them. I don't know why that happens. But once they're sealed, they're usually pretty good. And that's what I'll do in a race. I'll just put them on. It's kind of tough, though, if you go and do a warm-up swim, if they allow you to go right. do a warm-up swim, then it's like, do I keep them on for the next 10, 15 minutes while we're sitting on the beach? I don't know. But, yeah, that's a problem. If you get them wet, they seem to fog up quickly.
Well, and it's definitely planning ahead, you know, going with the suggestion of once they're on, don't touch them, planning ahead, and just getting experience with different brands. You know, it's kind of like wetsuit brands are a little bit fit differently. Mm-hmm. A Blue 70 wetsuit fits differently than an Xterra wetsuit or Aquasphere wetsuit. Depending on the distance of your eyes and, you know, whether you get little tiny goggles or bigger goggles.
Yeah.
So it just could be a matter of just trial and error.
Yeah, the fit is so important on maybe one eye. It could be on your eyebrow wrong. You could have, you know, a hair from your eyebrow get in the way and then it cracks the seal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can have the same brand, but it'll fit differently, the same just how they're manufactured. It's like a pair of jeans. Yeah, if I get a 32-32, they all may fit a little bit different.
Yeah.
Another swim-related question is another guy did his first triathlon this past weekend. That's awesome. Open water in a wetsuit, and he struggled with his breathing the entire swim. Hard to answer this without knowing more details, but I'm not sure why they were struggling. But if you have any suggestions, Wendy, for him on breathing in open water with his wetsuit.
Right. So when it comes to open water swimming, there's a few things that could cause breathlessness. First and foremost, maybe this athlete was not warmed up. There's a video that I've created on the Endurance Hour YouTube channel that explains a proper warm-up that you can do in the water if it's allowed at the venue. Mm-hmm. And then I also do another dry land video of how to warm up. The main thing about warming up is just get your heart rate up, get your breathing, get your heart rate elevated so you're breathing heavy, because that just kind of helps get your breathing in control. Another reason this athlete could have been breathless if it's his first open water swim and he just wasn't used to it. Sometimes you feel breathless because of the unknown. You can't see anything in the bottom. You don't know what lies beneath. There's bodies all over the place, and you're just quite not acclimated to maybe the temperature. That could cause breathlessness. A third thing that could cause breathlessness, if you've never worn a wetsuit before, the wetsuits are going to be restricting a little bit in the chest, and some of them have a high net in the neck. It could feel like it's restricting your breathing. And sometimes it will be if you get the wrong size. But for the most part, the more experience you have wearing a wetsuit, making sure it fits, making sure, you know, you pull it up properly so, you know, it's all the way up your body and making sure it's zipped right, maybe that'll release some tension in the chest area and it'll allow you to breathe better.
Excellent. I was thinking the same thing about a tight wetsuit on your chest, not allowing you to expand your ribs and your lungs as easily. Yeah. So it could be too tight. Moving on to a question. This is from Harrison. I don't know if it's too specific, but do you think someone who is in moderately good shape as a runner who has never biked before, who doesn't exercise legs that much, could have a 20-minute FTP of 263 on a bike?
So for those that don't know, FTP stands for functional threshold power, and you determine your functional threshold power. One of the protocols is a 20-minute all-out maximal effort, and then whatever your normalized or average power is for that 20 minutes, you take 95% of that, and that's your FTP or functional threshold power, theoretically the power that you can sustain for an hour on the bike. Now, of course, I could imagine that being possible, because your functional threshold power is also relative to your body weight in kilograms. And so a heavier athlete is going to have a higher functional threshold power number than a lighter athlete. Mm-hmm. And the lighter athlete couldn't, in the big picture, be faster than this heavier athlete with a higher functional threshold power. So I followed up with Harrison and I asked Harrison if he knew this athlete's body weight, And I did the calculations, and it ended up being his FTP, his function of watts per kilogram, watts divided by his body weight in kilograms, was about 2.5, which is an average watts per kilogram for this experience of this athlete. Mm-hmm. And so I think Harrison wasn't quite thinking how FTP was so related to how much an athlete weighs.
Yeah.
I've also, you know, speaking of FTP, I've had athletes in over the course of training increase their FTP, you know, every few months if they retook a test. Sometimes their FTP goes up a few watts. And I know, well, it could be because they put on 10 pounds, whether it's 10 pounds of muscle weight or 10 pounds of, you know, combination of fat or muscle weight or whatever. I know sometimes, you know, that's not really a good indication of improvement because you've put on weight. So yes, you're a heavier athlete, you could push more power just based on your body weight.
Got it.
And so doing the ratio of watts per kilogram is going to be a better indication of improved functional threshold power.
Absolutely. This one's from Melissa. Training for a half marathon, half Ironman. Quote, how long does it take to really start seeing improvements in pace for the run, I assume?
For the run. So there's a lot of ways you can, you know, determine whether you're making progress. I know she didn't use the word progress, but when I'm thinking improvements, I'm thinking of the word progress. Mm-hmm. So when you're determining if you're making improvements or progress, it's not necessarily always have to do with pace, because pace, your running pace is, you know, you got to factor in the nature of the terrain that you're running on, the weather, your fatigue level. There's so many, you know, factors that will impact your pace. So when I'm looking at, you know, improvements, I'm also looking at the progress of how well an athlete executed a training session, or how well an athlete executed a race. Did they follow the details as intended, or did they have to make modifications and adapt based on other factors? But in general, to kind of answer the question, I'm going to say at least 12 weeks of consistent training based on your level of fitness, and that you're going to see progress or see improvements. If you want to use that pace metric, you should probably see that. And again, I want to stress the word consistency. You know, if you're consistently following the plan as intended, then give it about 12 weeks, because that's kind of what I see in myself. I could start a new training plan if I'm focused on, you know, training for a 5K or focused on an ultra, or if I go from ultra training to maybe more multi-sport training for triathlon, I give myself 12 weeks before I even think about looking at whether I've made improvements in pace or threshold or power or, you know, whatever I'm using to measure my progress. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's kind of leads into our next question, and I just want to follow up by saying that I hope she's not only looking at pace, because heart rate is also one of those great indicators of your fitness level as well as improvement.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of ties into Eric's question. Rather than using heart rate zones for running, what are some other metrics y'all use? I'm finding, this is what he says, that where I live, it's impossible to use heart rate because the heat where I live can go from the mid-70s to mid-90s, you know, from one day to the next, and my heart rate is elevated. So I'm at an RPE of 2, for example, and then next day it could be a little bit different just because of the weather conditions.
Yeah, now he kind of, you know, thanks for the question, Eric. You kind of answered your own question. What other metric can you use? I was going to suggest you use rate of perceived effort. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't, some people might not even think of that as a metric, but that's really the main number that I like to follow in my workouts is my perception and how I'm perceive the level of effort I'm giving. And then I like to look at my power or heart rate or pace to give me feedback based on how I felt. So when it comes to heart rate training, I think the biggest thing that will impact heart rate training is weather, humidity, as well as dry conditions. And the humidity, I find that the heart rate skyrockets more at a lower perceived effort than it does in the dry heat that I used to live in Colorado. but heat's a huge factor that's going to impact heart rate. So if you're in a race or in a training session, but I want to specifically focus on a race, and you're running and you're especially off the bike, your heart rate's high. Let's say, you know, like 170, where that would normally be maybe in your threshold or zone four effort, but your effort at that point is like a five. I would say, okay, don't just forget about heart rate for a while, and don't feel like you have to slow down because your heart rate's that high. If you don't have any, you know, previous health conditions for your heart, I would just continue to race by effort and just let the heart rate go, because, you know, besides weather, you have hydration as well as nutrition. You know, did you consume enough carbohydrate? That's going to impact heart rate. Did you consume enough fluid, whether it's water and electrolyte mix? That's going to impact heart rate. Did you get a lot of sleep? So going back to a training session, did you get only like 3 or 4 hours sleep and you're used to sleeping like 7 or 8 hours? Well, then the next day your training heart rate may be high at a relatively low rate of perceived effort. Mm-hmm. So again, it's good to use the data, and the data is very helpful, or the metric data is very helpful to learn your rate of perceived effort. But ultimately, I would suggest he continue to train by rate of perceived effort. But also, there's also Stride running power meters. There's probably other power meters out there, but I'm just mostly familiar with the Stride. He can run by power. And again, that's not going to be impacted by his rate of perceived effort, might be impacted by the weather, but when it comes to power, that's the absolute measure of workload. So his workload shouldn't change because it's hot or cooler out.
Do you still have a discount to Stride in the newsletter?
We do. We do have a 15%, I think it's 15 or 20% discount code to our newsletter subscribers.
Okay. EnduranceHour.com if you're interested. Debbie asks, I have a quick question about kits for a half and full distance Ironman, speaking about what she wears. Do you wear a tri-suit, or do you wear a full kit change, do a full kit change in T1 and T2? Probably, I don't know. I have only ever raced an Olympic in which I wore the tri-suit, but can't imagine it would be the most comfortable option over those distances, the tri-suit over the half or full distance. I'm not going to be leading the race, so I'm not worried about saving time. What's your answer to her about wearing a tri-suit or do a full change?
Yeah, so I've worn a tri-kit, whether it's a full one-piece or whether it's a tri-top and tri-bottom. They're made to be comfortable. I mean, back in the day when I started wearing them, I would wear them and I wouldn't even wear a wetsuit over them. That would be what I would swim in, bike in, and run in. They're made, the material, the padding on the short, to be used again in the iron distance event. The only time I actually changed, and it's the only time ever in my life I've ever changed, was at Ironman Florida 2021, because the temperatures were so cold, I didn't want to be wet when I got on my bike. So I wore a swimsuit. I wore a wetsuit over my swimsuit. And so I had all my gear in my transition bag, and I took my wetsuit completely off and I put on my cycling and running kit. And then I finished the race in my race kit. I had a changing tent, so I was very comfortable changing in the changing tent. Mm-hmm. Now, for Debbie's sake, if you're concerned about the comfort level, you should be in training wearing what you plan to wear race day for your longer ride, longer run, so you know if there's any spots that you might get chafing in, or any just something that's rubbing you the wrong way, so you're a little bit more comfortable with the knowledge to know what you should do on race day, whether you should wear it for the whole event or not.
Yeah, it's interesting when you always say, and it's kind of the standard line, don't try anything new on race day. So don't wear a brand new, don't pull out the tags the night before and go, hey, I'm going to lay out my stuff, I'm going to take my pictures for Instagram, and I'm going to wear this new kit tomorrow, which I've never worn before. Bad idea. Try it out in practice.
Yeah, and try it out in practice. And there are people that will wear a swimsuit and then they'll go in the changing tent. And that's the benefit of most 70.3s and 140.6, is there are changing tents. And they will put on a cycling jersey and cycling shorts with a thicker pad in them, and they'll bike their 112 miles or if it's a half, 56 miles, and then they'll get into T2 and take all that cycling gear off, and they'll put on a running singlet and a running pair of shorts, and they run in that. And that's totally acceptable. You're not going to be the only one doing it. Even though you're not, you say time's not a factor. It could be, because there are cutoffs. So, you know, sometimes you think, you know, I'm just going to finish. I'm not concerned about my time, until you go to a race like Ironman Texas that happened a few weeks ago, where it was brutal wind. And a lot of athletes I know who did that race, they added like 30 to 60 minutes to their bike time. So they were fighting the cutoffs. And so you want to make sure, if you're not fighting any cutoffs and you can take a little extra longer in the transitions to change, then go for it. Just make sure you know what your plan is ahead of time, so you're not making those on the fly decisions.
I can imagine, I can see where someone might change into some running gear from their bike, just because, you know, if it's been a long day, you know, you've been out there for a long time, it's wet, maybe the pad on your shorts is a little squishy from sweat or water or whatever, you might want to change it out to shorts and a singlet. But you're also conditioned based in training of wearing, I don't know why I would ever change from throughout the day, unless it's just something comfort wise, or I'll have as a spare in my bag just right in case, but I'm prepared to go with the thinner pad throughout the whole day in my shorts. Sounds funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know why I would do that, because you should be used to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, few people will be doing their first race as a half or a full. If you do that, wear in training what you'll wear on race day a few times, so you're familiar and you're in the saddle. So you should be, your body should be conditioned for that feel, I would think.
Yeah.
Also another thing on race day, and I just have my bike tuned up. It's been in the place, the shop place, for like 3 weeks because they're backed up. Everyone's backed up. I mean, I was there yesterday getting my bike and someone called and goes, "Hey, can I do this? Blah, blah, blah." He goes, "Yeah, we're about 3 to 6 weeks out. If you want your bike, you're tuned up in a matter of 3 weeks, if you can wait that long." And go, I couldn't wait that long. Not right now. That's why I dropped mine off, you know, 3 weeks ago and finally got it back. But, I have some race wheels and they are tubular. So it's all one piece that's glued in. And so I had him put that in there for me. And he goes, "Hey, you know, go to 140 PSI at the most and you should be okay, especially on the straightaways. But around corners, it could get slick." I'm going, "Ooh, I better ride these a few weeks prior, so the wheels, the rubber on the wheels kind of gets, you know, worked in a little bit. Otherwise, I can go to 110, 120 PSI and I'll be fine anyway." So these are just, you know, a couple of things as we're talking about trying things before race day. Same thing with wheel sets. Tried them. My wheel sets a little more aerodynamic than my, of course, obviously my training wheels. But just a couple of reminders that try these things on. Make sure your bike is ready. You're ready. Your shoes are ready. Break them in ahead of time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that just, I'm going to add two more components to that. One race, one time I bought the pair of shoes, the exact same brand, exact same model. I bought them at an expo the day before the race. I wore them because they weren't broken in. I got a hot spot. And so the bottom of my foot hurt. This was for an iron distance. The bottom of my foot hurt for like the last half marathon. Mm. And I knew why. It was because of the shoes. Yeah. And then another time, again, I didn't think anything about it. I put stretchy elastic laces on my shoes the day before the race, and during the race the top of my foot was killing me. I just could not figure out why. I'm like, my foot is numb. And this was for a 70.3, so a 13.1 mile run, and probably the last 4 miles I actually took my shoe off and it felt better. And I'm like, oh my gosh, it's these laces are too tight. And there was nothing I could do about it in the moment, but I just needed that sense of relief from my foot for a second so I could unnumb it. Mm-hmm. And then once I recognized it was the laces were too tight, I was able to get through my race just fine, because I'm like, okay, it's not an injury. I just kind of was dumb and put these laces on the day before the race and I didn't test them out beforehand.
This might be obvious, but one more thing to Debbie, you know, talking about changing clothes or having, you know, different options. my personal experience, and it might be similar to you, you have a couple of options on your bike, socks or no socks. And then same thing with the run, depends on the distance, but most likely, do you change your socks between the bike and the run? I do. I want to have a fresh pair of dry socks for the run. And one thing, reasons why, is because let's say on the bike, I've mentioned this before, but just, you know, new things and reminders that when you're drinking fluids, it goes down your body, down your legs, can pool up to a degree in your feet and pre-soak your feet, mm-hmm. especially if you're not wearing, well, even if you're wearing socks, then it's going to hold that moisture in there for a long time. And I've had issues with blisters as a result, especially on a hot run. If you, I'm going to change my socks out, but your feet are wet, it's a hot day, it's going to be humid. It could be humid, and your feet are never going to get a chance to dry out. So different socks is something I would also, little tip there in between running bike and run.
Yes, it's a good one.
That we have a couple of more questions, but we'll save them because we kind of crossed over, you know, the half hour mark here for this podcast. And these are great questions. Where are you getting most of your questions received, Wendy? On Facebook, email, where are you finding them?
Yeah, so some athletes will email me. Some athletes that I coach will post them in their Training Peaks training log. Mm. And then some athletes post in our T2 Endurance Facebook group. And there's one or two that we answered today that were actually from other Facebook groups that I belong to that I thought were really good questions to include in the podcast. So, again, I think the best place is to join, if you're not already, our T2 Endurance Facebook group. Post questions there, because then that creates a lot of communication and a lot of chatter amongst the members. We all love to help each other out. We all love to share our own experience with each other. So that's, I think, the best way. But you can reach me on email as well.
Well, it looks like we've got 4 requests for membership, and we have 697 members in our T2 Endurance Club group on Facebook. It's a private group, so you have to answer some questions before we let you in. That way we know that you're for real and that you're serious about it and that you can contribute to the group. 2 of them here look like they're people that we can enter. Two other ones are not. They're people I've asked to clarify in the past and they haven't done a follow-up. So I want to add 2 more. That'll take us to 699. And that is, one is Patrick. It's probably the guy you're talking about, right? From Georgia? Woodstock, Georgia?
Yeah.
He studied finance at Kennesaw State University. Is that also in Georgia?
Yeah.
Okay. So he heard about the group thanks to Wendy, and he's training for a 70.3 in Spartan race, and he has a Training Peaks account. So we're going to say approve him. Now, why do we ask about the Training Peaks account if people have gotten this far and don't know?
Dave and I have actually created a bunch of training plans, swim-related, bike-related, run-related, as well as multi-sport-related. I'm going to say 26. And most endurance athletes know what Training Peaks is, so that's just another validation that they're an endurance athlete.
Cool. The other one is Daniel, and he requested a week ago, and I think I emailed him, but based on his photos from his profile, it seems pretty obvious. He heard about us through the newsletter, and he's training for an Ironman, and he does have a Training Peaks account. So Daniel's going to be 699. Maybe you'll be 700. So after listening to this podcast, request to join the group, and you'll be in the 700 club.
Nice.
All right, that wraps up this episode. We're good to go, Wendy?
Yep.
Okay, thank you so much for listening to episode 355 of the podcast. And if you're racing the Ironman World Championship in St. George this weekend, good luck to you. If you do race in it, let us know how it went in the T2 Endurance Club, or send us a message or follow us on Instagram and let us know there. It'd be kind of cool.
Yeah.
You have athletes racing this weekend?
I'm not coaching anyone that's racing. I just have a lot of friends that I know who are racing, and they're already on my tracker.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
And so I'm excited because, you know, sometimes I'm in Georgia now. I know a lot of people in Colorado. I'll see a friend of mine in Colorado post something on Facebook, and then I'll immediately go to my tracker because I don't want to forget about them.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited. I just texted my good friend Kirsten, who is doing it, and I think she just arrived today. So I texted her and I asked her, does it feel like the world championship? Because she has been to Kona. So I'm waiting for her response to let me know, like, kind of the vibe of, does it feel like a typical St. George Ironman event, or does it feel like a little bit different because it is a world championship event this year? So we can talk about that once I get her response.
I bet it'll feel like a world championship event, the signage, but also maybe the buzz with the people who are there. But my guess, it's not going to feel like a Kona world championship because it's kind of hard to replicate that on the mainland when you don't have a beautiful ocean view and palm trees around. Right. Yeah. But I'm sure it's still going to be as challenging and an honest course for sure.
Yeah.
For Wendy Mader, I'm Dave Erickson. We appreciate you listening and following us. We'll see you next week and have a great week of training, racing, or recovery. Adios.
Adios.